rights group protests the treatment of supervillains in the nation's magnetic detainment cubes. A local dad thought he could make it out of a zoo without buying his kids light-up shit. And a pigeon wishes just once it could complete a head movement smoothly. Stripped down to its essential ingredients to provide as clean a high as possible, this is...
Injection, fellas.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds.
Religious after-school programs should include all religions, including the Satanic Temple. That is according to the group that's starting the Satan Club program across the country. The group tells us they actually don't believe in God or Satan.
We don't believe in a God or a Satan. Satan to us is a literary figure that embodies eternal rebellion against tyranny. So, you know, we're not there to convert your kids to Satanism. We're just there to provide another alternative.
The group sent out this letter to Centennial Elementary School that's in Mount Vernon, and it includes the Supreme Court ruling that Good News Club, a Christian-based group, and other religious groups are allowed as long as they don't use public funds. They say they're also looking at adding clubs in Tacoma and Puyallup.
The bigger you build the bonfire, the more darkness you will reveal.
And now we come to the great man himself, a man history records as being instrumental in the creation of America's public education system. Horace Mann was an American educator who served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, part of the American Congress. Horace Mann was the key reformer of the education system at the time. In 1837, he became the head of the newly created Board of Education in Massachusetts, where he began the work that would eventually earn him the title as the Father of American Public Education. After reading through the educational models of different countries, Mann finally hears about a particularly successful style that had been developed in Prussia, which is now modern-day Germany. The Prussian system had shown to be such a success for the government's purposes that, accompanied by a few other educators, Horace Mann travels to Germany to investigate. Upon their return to the United States, they lobbied heavily to have the Prussian model adopted.
All in favor say aye!
Interest in Prussia had also been growing in the northern half of the continent. Around this time, the Canadian superintendent of schools, Egerton Ryerson, traveled to Prussia in search of a new model of education. His journeys also included visiting Horace Mann in Massachusetts to further examine the system he would eventually adopt. George Brown, the editor of Toronto's Globe newspaper, was even quoted saying that Ryerson had successfully imported Prussian education into Ontario. During the next 30 years or so, a whole line of American dignitaries came to Germany to earn degrees. Interestingly enough, those who earned degrees in Germany came back to the United States to staff all the major universities. By 1900, all the PhDs in the United States were trained in Prussia. As the first secretary of the State Board of Education, Horace Mann promoted his new concept that the state is the father of children. He stressed that it was the responsibility of the state to ensure that education was provided for the child. A very noble idea, of course, but what exactly did he mean by that? And how did he define education? It seems like a very broad subject. It is a very broad subject. Education encompasses all of human history and all the knowledge we have gathered during that time. Not to mention, and perhaps most importantly, what we as human beings learn over our lifetime on a personal level. Horace Mann's 10th annual report in 1846 led to the first state law that made it mandatory for children to go to school. It was during that year that he supported the governor of Massachusetts in adopting the Prussian model of education for the entire state. How did he do that? The governor of the time, Edward Everett, as it turns out, was the very first to receive a PhD from, can you guess where? That's right, Prussia. From then on, it spread very quickly. Just after Everett installed the Prussian model in the state of Massachusetts, the governor of New York set up the very same method in 12 New York schools. Horace Mann's sister, Elizabeth Peabody, of the Peabody Foundation, saw to it that right after the Civil War, the Prussian system that was then being taught in the northern states was integrated into the conquered South. By 1900, most of the compulsory schooling laws that implemented the new system had been passed. From then on, every American child grew up under the Prussian system. So what exactly was the Prussian education system that everyone thought was so amazing that it just had to be adopted throughout the free world? To give you just a bit of background, in the 18th century, the Kingdom of Prussia, which is now modern-day Germany, was among the first countries of the world to introduce free and compulsory education. After the Prussians were defeated by Napoleon in 1806, it was decided that the reason why the battle was lost was that the Prussian soldiers were thinking for themselves in the battlefield instead of following orders. To make sure that this couldn't happen again, a new 8-year system of schooling was created. This new system provided not only the skills needed for the early industrialized world, such as reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also a strict education that taught duty, discipline, respect for authority, and the ability to follow orders. Elite children destined for higher offices went on to attend private schools, while the rest of the population had no access to the secondary education. They were destined for the working class. Through this new system, the Prussian court tried to create social obedience in the citizens through indoctrination. Every individual had to become convinced at the core of their being that the king was just, his decisions were always right, and the need for obedience paramount. In truth, the entire purpose of the system was to instill loyalty to the crown and to train young men for the military and bureaucracy. To do this, it was necessary to squeeze out all independent thinking from the masses. Influencing this new system from the beginning was Prussian philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte. Combining John Locke's view that the children are a blank slate and Rousseau's ideas on how to write on that slate, Prussia established an educational system that was considered scientific in nature. An important part of the Prussian system was that it defined for the child what was to be learned, what was to be thought about, and how long to think about it. In order to have an efficient policy-making class and a subclass beneath it, it was believed that one had to remove the power of most people to make sense out of the available information. In other words, critical thinking had to be done away with. Now, if you're wondering why the average person doesn't know that the North American education system is based directly on the Prussian model, it might just be because its original purpose was not designed for the good of the individual, but for the good of the government. The philosophy of Johann Fichte directly influenced the creation of the Prussian model of schooling, as he is quoted saying, "The schools must fashion the person, and fashion him in such a way that he simply cannot will otherwise than what you wish him to will." With quotes like these, you can see why his involvement is not well known. Education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils are thus schooled, they will be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished. When this technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for more than one generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. In 1807, in a Berlin occupied by Napoleon, Johann Fichte gave a series of famous addresses to the German nation. Fichte spoke of the superiority of German people above all others. The content of these speeches was a catalyst for the Prussian education system and German nationalism. In other earlier works, he calls Jews a state within a state that would, quote, undermine the German nation. He openly expressed a desire to expel Jews from Germany. Fichte had a deep influence on the rise of the Third Reich, and continues to be deemed, quote, the spiritual father of modern neo-Nazism. Which begs the question, why would the father of American education make it a law that every child spend their youth in a system created by the father of neo-Nazism? Historians reflect that one of the greatest social factors that allowed a man like Hitler to rise to power was that the German people had been bred from birth to respect authority above all else and accept it without question. Which begs another question. If the entire population of North America is raised in a system adopted from pre-Nazi Germany, what are we setting ourselves up for?
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Hey, look, you know, like, if you bought this record to learn how to speak hip from a record man, that is the squarest thing I ever heard of. I mean, wow. Look, so like you bought it, you must need it. So that was a smart move, you know what I mean, or something?
Hello there, and welcome to the exciting world of hip.
Oh, just relax, baby. Me and this other cat, we're going to straighten you out.
This is a new departure in language instruction for English-speaking people who want to talk to and be understood by jazz musicians, hipsters, beatniks, juvenile delinquents, and the criminal fringe.
What time is it, man? I got to make a phone call.
Shh. The twilight world of the American hipster is an important American subculture with a language all its own. To enable you to speak this language of hip exactly like the hipsters themselves, we've provided an actual hipster to teach you the correct pronunciation and delivery of his language.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, your instructor, Mr. Geets Romo.
Look, this is going to be a long session, man. Let's head out for some pizza or something.
Mr. Romo, would you speak into the microphone, please?
I just want to say this is a wonderful thing, what you're doing, you know? So the public can pick up on what's happening, like, you know? Straighten everybody out and let them know where this whole other scene is, where it's at. You know, so everybody will stop coming on all the time. And then we'll get, you know, world peace.
Lesson 2, vocabulary building. No doubt some of the expressions Mr. Romo has just used are unfamiliar to you. Let's examine some of these phrases more closely. Mr. Geets Romo, your instructor, will pronounce a series of hip words and phrases. After each one, there will be a pause so that you can repeat the phrase aloud. Mr. Romo.
Dig. Dig it. Dig yourself, baby. Dig the chick. Dig the cat. Dig the shades on the cat. Yeah, that's where it's at. Dig. Squares. What a drag. What a bring down. Later for that, man. Forget it.
Greetings and farewells. Greetings.
Hey, do you have any idea how boring this must be?
Oh,
what a
please,
drag.
Please, Mr. Romo, just read your little list.
Oh, man. Hey, what's happening, baby? What's shaking, man? Hey, there you go. Hey.
And farewells.
Hey, I'm going to split. This is a drag. I'm going to cut. You got eyes to split? Let's make it. You going uptown? I got wheels.
Jiggy Jabba Joe, vitamin idol and primal rages when Bible Page versus Tidal Wave begun.
What or what?
I wrote the book that shook America to splinters in a winter wasteland, icicle bound barren township.
Or Baron Munchausen's proud gimps to clinch this chemical war pit.
Delinquent sinking like a paper tugboat well beneath your holidays. Beached on a red tide infested shore, corroding eastern seaboard beauty.
I'm a jigsaw slap.
But all the pig saw was dirt bag.
It's like a pleading comet bombing on your
silver riverside park tunnel. People claim last life form standing. Carbon based pardons in enough. My still's truly personified. This urbanite flea circus, we urchins murking on daily.
I catapult brain opera fast pace.
Tear my own face open, the finale. Stick around, it's ill. Diabolical, prodigal son, spill grimace. If you had one more eye, you'd be a cyclops, which explains missing the premise. Implicit mimic, baptized, chastised, laugh, die, kiss the finish, kiss the villagers, the floor.
Need a pipe of pick peppers and run rock rhyme.
Ace rock might have smoked one too many dimes in its time. And where you gonna be when the sun falls, brother? Probably gathering your sheep with all these other motherfuckers. I'll get struck twice in the same place by a moody Zeus fist ladder. Smack the dirt clear out the park, going gone.
To infinity and beyond.
I'm locked like a Chewbacca, lookalikes and magic makers. Hermit crabs in New York City, super alligators. Keep your honily, dream out your homily. I deal with tangible goods and avoid manufacturing food for landfills.
I see friends bow to needles.
I see needles bow to records.
I see vows break.
I see God bow and make the clouds shake. I seen the proud break. I seen a lot for a blind soldier who tattooed a cityscape while skin to blend in. Rats travel by night and bite the water bugs. I'm here to pull a three prong when it's prompt. Direct the wormhole of self-sacrifice.
Add a hatchet slice for kids.
So they got over Frankenstein. Scar with his style. Someday be a story, my kid.
Life's hard.
Life's easy.
Life's everything in between.
Life's peachy like James and a giant. And I keep spitting as long as these kittens fly it. And I keep casting my line as long as these fish are blighted. And I like
don't
it.
Don't try it like that.
Wild is love. That's the way it goes, huh? Maybe I should just give up. Or just stop trying. But life is so uncertain. So short. I've got to keep on searching. And wherever it takes me, I've got to go.
Ran away.
way. Temper tantrum, decrepit anthem, set a low goal. I arrive late. I'm here to scrape a car clean to the funk machine imposes on the underling amalgam cluster and identifies the mother. Got hard, I hate to tell you, but it skips more than it palpitates. Like these here little drunken archers miss more than they calculate. The falcon hates the mockingbird. The farmer hates the drought. I hate them all. I kick the bottom brick out, shouting yes to y'all and blow the village out perspective.
ASAP.
Do you take this makeshift Candyland called classic bastard style to be an awfully wedded head trip to embrace throughout sickness, health, electrical storm, fire, pain, rain, hail, wind, ice, sleep,
snow? No.
I'm balanced, sonified, phantom to the bone, walking like a Jabberwocky, scalping a pair of one-way tickets to shadow boxing. Just like Christmas with a shallow stock in life.
I'm just trying to milk the mileage.
Drop science like Don Herbert with liquor in him.
Sounding off like senior citizens sitting at Bingo Parlor bickering.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? How I can feel when you can just sit there bitching about your syllabus.
Decades, parents have lamented the state of the public education system and the dumbing down of generations of children. In response, organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are investing millions of dollars in programs they say are designed to improve that system. Now, critics like Dr. James Tracy of MemoryGap.org are warning that these so-called cures are just more of the same technocratic manipulation that created the problem in the first place. This is the GRTV feature interview with your host, James Corbett, and our special guest, Dr. James F. Tracy. Well, I'd like to start today by talking about a very interesting and important article you wrote called The Technocratization of Public Education, detailing some of the history of the last century or so of very elite and well-connected families funding thinkers who want to shape the public education system. And you start out that article with a very specific discussion of a Gates Foundation-funded program called the Measures of Effective Teachers Project. So perhaps you can tell us about this project and its significance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Measures of Effective Teachers Project is part of a $45 million plan to quantify, to measure school teachers' alleged efficiency in delivering the public school curriculum. The project has a great many individuals involved, including academic psychologists, sociologists, education scholars, even a statistician from the RAND Corporation. The experiment began in 2009 and focuses mainly on inner city schools. Now, the whole idea behind this is the establishment of a metrics for identifying techniques to maintain young people's attention spans. This looks to be, in part, a type of audience research, complete with galvanic skin bracelets to measure student behaviors and reactions. So the ostensible use of the data will be to determine how teachers will be hired, compensated, promoted, and so on. We have to be put on guard when we hear terms such as measurement or quantification, especially when it comes to education and teaching, because these were the techniques originally used to bring psychology into the American educational enterprise to begin with. The fact that this is being done to mainly African-American and Latino children in inner-city schools should also call to mind how early social science has been used to perpetuate eugenics and emphasize the alleged racially specific inferiorities of non-whites. So the project overall essentially involves the dehumanization of what is an inherently human process, that is, cultivating individuals to recognize and aspire to a higher intellectual level. The public school curriculum, the abundance of standardized testing, and now programs like these collectively act as a harness on real education. It's an attempt to refine the psychological conditioning and curriculum delivery process for a curriculum that is more or less dead on arrival and intended to discourage independent thought and curiosity.
Teacher's pet, I wanna be teacher's pet. I wanna be huddled and cuddled as close to you as I can get.
That's the lesson, we're guessing your best in
teacher's pride. I wanna be teacher's pride. I wanna be dated and rated, most likely at your side.
You gotta burn and yearn to learn.
I wanna learn all your lips can teach me. One kiss will do at the start. I'm sure with a little homework I'll graduate to your heart. Teacher's pet, I wanna be teacher's pet. I wanna take home a diploma and show Ma that you love me too.
That you love me too.
So I can be a teacher's pet long after school is through. The stars. I'm sure with a little homework I'll graduate to your heart. Teacher's pet.
You love the teacher.
I wanna be teacher's pet. I wanna take home a diploma and show Ma that you love me too.
As you point out in this article, this specific project from the Gates Foundation is really only the latest and the most high-tech step in a century-long process that has been attempting to apply various psychological conditioning techniques in the public school system. So let's talk about those techniques in the American education system context. Who brought these techniques to the American public education system, and why did they do that?
Mm-hmm. There's a broad historical context for this that is rooted in European history and political thought that's largely been overlooked by most academics. This dates to at least the 17th century. However, if we are to locate a single individual and condition for the state of education today, we have to look to Wilhelm Wundt, who is the Prussian professor of psychology at the University of Leipzig in the late 19th century. When American higher education was in the process of being professionalized, most Americans who sought to obtain the professional academic degree, the Doctor of Philosophy, went to Germany to study. Now, ironically, a Doctor of Philosophy in Wundtian psychology was a PhD essentially devoid of any appreciation for or training in philosophy. Wundt developed what he termed experimental psychology, where the measurement and the recording of behavior or other observable phenomena was seen as necessary for knowledge production. In this framework, the human subject was recognized as devoid of any soul, will, or self-determination. Anything that could not be quantified was bracketed off and not worthy of consideration. The research subject, individuals or groups of individuals, came to be recognized as a stimulus response mechanism, and thus without will, they became docile and essentially dehumanized entities. So Wundt trains a great many American psychologists who returned from Germany and essentially established the field of psychology in the United States. They are largely behavioristic in their research approaches. For example, John Dewey is trained at Johns Hopkins by a student of Wundt's, G. Stanley Hall. Dewey and other Wundtians like James McKean Cattell, James Earl Russell, and Edward Thorndike go on to apply experimental psychological techniques to somewhat famously revise the educational practices at and found Columbia Teachers College at Columbia University. So with this, students come to be increasingly recognized as test subjects or stimulus response mechanisms. Wundt's disciples are especially influential because they have developed the psychological discipline, and they're at the leading institutions like Columbia, Johns Hopkins, and Chicago. These psychologists believed they were part of ushering in a new age. In many ways, they were. They sought to bring about a new being that would be more readily adapt to a socialist state, or what they termed the Great Society. This was a vision of progressive activists of the period for education specifically.
Please read from sheets. I am.
I am.
Sofa King.
Sofa King.
Scared of a bunch of water and get out the rain. Order a wrapper for lunch and spit out the chain. Then kick a lungy off the tip of his timbo and trick a honey dip into a game of strip limbo. Odd, he couldn't find no remorse. A wink is as good as a nod to a blind horse. Of course, his technique was from a divine source. Never knew the price of ice or what swine cost. One guy tried to bite the heat. It's when he discovered the other white meat. Oh, the one they hate so well. He sure keeps his cycle like the old Bates Motel. They came to ask him for at least some new tracks, but only got confronted by the beast with two backs. Knock, Mouse is a made man. Villain laid it down like the best laid plan. Bell the cat, who the hell is that near the middle? Got y'all, but it's not all bear and skittles. Prepare the vittles, got riddles and spittles. Crystal clear to the jot or the tittle. Hot off the griddle, came to take the cake whether there's a lot or a little. Kaboom, Doom is nervous large. You could tell by his blooming room service charge. Dark and tall to boot, the only thing was wrong is he was bald as a coot. Used to ran a van from Peter Pan to Red and Tan, and keep the human foot for his dead man's hand. This was when the mask was brand spanking new, before it got rusted from drinking all the brew. Stankin' too, pew. Kept all his earnings in the bank in a shoe. Spat what he knew, energy for true. To all fake rap, it's 23 skidoo. Excuse you, any room in the class front? Four blasts of the blunt, shrooming since last month. Doom a human in the mask, born to stunt. Danger zooming past, mad fast on the hunt. Keep your streets, we got the city neatly conquered. Discreetly with the CD till they be completely bonkered. The fans demanded it, handle it, swallow it. His own brand of shit, if only he could bottle it. Nah, she could get messy. Feds try to torture him for the secret recipe. He said it's no use, I only know half. No speak of the English, I only do the math. Felt no pain, his brain was saturated with cocaine and Rogaine. He said try scam, no ding, three card dead. Fly man, go for bling, he got bled. Eye jam over sting, see spots red. I am sofa king,
we tarred Ed.
We tarred Ed.
Now repeat all very fast, please.
I am sofa king.
Faster.
I am sofa king.
We tarred Ed. No, not so fast. Loses meaning.
I am sofa king.
We tarred Ed. You say funny thing.
The conditions and sentiment are similar in sociology, which in some way provides the basis for experimental psychology's application in educational settings. The sociologists Robert Park and Elbian Small had also been trained in Germany in the late 19th century and subsequently established the famous Chicago School of Sociology at the University of Chicago in the early 1900s. A specific conceptualization of society in German social scientists at the time is that society is a functioning organism akin to a biological entity. This was termed the organismic theory of society and is developed by German social theorist Albert Schaffel and the English sociologist Herbert Spencer in the late 1800s. Schaffel and Spencer exert a tremendous influence on early American sociology through the Chicago School. And Robert Park, it is fairly well known, uses the city of Chicago as a living laboratory to study various social phenomena. The first undergraduate sociology textbook, An Introduction to the Study of Society, is written by Small and George Vincent. And Vincent is the vice chancellor of the Chautauqua System of Education. In this book, Small and Vincent discuss how the society is a psychophysical communicating apparatus, with the individual being a communicating and terminal cell in the social biological organism. In the view of the early American sociologists, a threat to the functioning of the collective organism is posed in the transition from community to society. There was a fear and a suspicion of the mob or the rabble, and a way of taming and disarming that threat was through educational practices employing the new psychology. If individuals can be deprived of their self-determination, they will be more efficiently managed cells and readily integrated constituents of the social organism, whether the organism be a city, a nation state, or a planetary population. There will be no cause for dissent if one is devoid of their individuality and will and are absorbed into the collective.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Where am I?
In the village.
Who are you?
The new number 2.
You are number 6.
Who is number 1?
That would be telling.
What do you want?
We want information.
Information. Information.
You won't get it. By hook or by crook, we will.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Whose side are you on?
That would be telling.
Obey the rules, and we will take good care of you.
The community can rest assured that their interests are very much my own, and that anything I can do to maintain the security of the citizens will be my primary objective.
You are number 6.
Who is number 1?
I am not a number.
Who is number 1?
I am a free man.
Who is number 1?
We want information.
Information. Information. Who is number 1? Who is number 1?
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Be seeing you.
So from your research, why are rich families like the Rockefellers and the Gates, historically, why have they been funding these types of programs? What purpose do they serve for these types of people?
I think there are a number of reasons, and your listeners, and I think that some of the global research audience will be aware of these to at least some degree. U.S. tax laws beginning in 1913 under the Federal Reserve Act allow for wealthy families like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies to establish tax-free foundations where such families can dole out money to interests and projects they deem worthy. This allows them to steer much of the social and scientific research of academic, government, and private entities. The practice of philanthropy made possible by such laws has helped to salvage and prop up the public image of these families. John D. Rockefeller, for example, John D. Sr., regarded the $45 million donated to the founding of the University of Chicago as his greatest investment because the public identifies education with scientific progress and social uplift. For the Rockefeller family, it was a public relations coup. The key for any philanthropic project is to make it look as if the money is somehow benefiting the public. This burnishes the image of the philanthropic entity in the public eye. if we look more closely at what types of projects are being funded and have been funded over the years, we can see how some of these powerful families are really much more concerned with things like social engineering. For example, you look at the millions of dollars that the Rockefeller Foundation puts into the green movement. Not only does it make that family look good, it also creates a semblance of a serious problem that can be used to shape social behavior and a host of related agendas. Another example is the Measure of Effective Teachers project of the Gates Foundation that we're discussing. It sounds nice on the surface, but this is a multi-million dollar undertaking that transforms public school classrooms into psychological laboratories complete with human test subjects. And how will the information be used? Will the information be used to assist in helping to overcome resistance to vaccine programs in developing nations? Will it be used to program video games and so-called educational software? The public is told that the Gates want to help teaching in schools, but this in all likelihood, is a way to gain access to a particularly vulnerable group of human subjects and generate a wealth of data for future projects in social engineering. These wealthy individuals also live in a world apart from the rest of the Earth's population, both literally and figuratively. Once someone has incredible riches, they often develop the belief that they're a few steps above mere mortals and actually know what's best for the human race and the planet that we're on. If the population has been socially conditioned to be stimulus response mechanisms and behave like animals, if they've been trained in such a way as to overlook their self-determination, then it's especially convenient for these elites, or at least a portion of them, to regard the masses as nothing more than mere livestock. This is what spokespersons for wealthy interests such as Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann asserted back in the 1920s, that the public is dumb, that the public has an average IQ of about 100, the masses are driven by irrational drives. They're hopeless spectators. What figures such as Lippmann and Bernays don't say is that the public has to a large degree been made this way through mass education and mass media. This is really blaming the victims of propaganda and social psychological conditioning. So the public is increasingly thought of as superfluous apart from its economic necessity as labor power. Again, if you consider the ideas of Ray Kurzweil, Nicholas Negroponte, or Bill Joy, and I know that you've discussed some of these on your program, for example, James, the global elites have their sights set years ahead of what we're taught to think about in news and popular culture. Their world is what is presented to us as science fiction. They have a vision that's much different from what the broader public has been taught to anticipate.
Facing changes, no one knows what's going on, and everyone is changing places. Still, the world keeps moving on. Love must always change to sorrow, and everyone must play the game, because it's here today and gone tomorrow. Still, the world goes on the same.
always churn the sorrow, and everyone must play the game, because it's here today and gone tomorrow. Still the world goes on the same. Tomorrow, still the world goes on the same.
That's chapter one. Would you like to have chapter two? You better, son of a bitch, I know the way.
If you have a watch or a clock nearby, take a look at its hour hand. It moves, completing a trip all the way around twice a day. Its motion is too slow to see, but try. Really look at it, all right? Now, watch how far it travels in 1 second, okay? One Mississippi. Done, that's it. See how far it moved? Well, if this watch was the Milky Way, that would be about how far we have traveled in our solar system around our galaxy since the invention of writing. Since the beginning, not of time, but of our history. It's a very small distance, unnoticeable. For most of humanity's existence, there hasn't been writing, physical recordings of events or ideas. Today, of course, we have writing, and we have many different ways to physically store data. We even now have digital ones. But before writing was invented, all humans had was biological storage. Memories. There was no Wikipedia, no phone book, no library. But what there was old people. Of everyone around, they've experienced the most, heard the most things, had the most thoughts. Even today, with all this stuff around, the oldest among us remain the libraries of things that physical and digital libraries either don't, haven't been, or can't yet chronicle. Aeschylus famously said that memory is the mother of wisdom. But like all storage formats, individuals don't last forever. These can be lost. We can die. These can obsolesce. They can still be around, but have no way to be played back or read. They can be abandoned, ignored. These can also just wear out, just as we can forget or develop dementia. Dementia involves a decline in cognitive skills used to perform everyday activities. 60 to 80% of dementia cases are Alzheimer's. The disease is associated with the accumulation of plaques and tangles in the brain, changes accompanied by damage to brain cells and their death. The older a person is, the more likely they are to have developed Alzheimer's. But Alzheimer's is not a part of normal aging. Symptoms of Alzheimer's disease include a decrease in the ability to think and remember, confusion about time and place, new difficulties speaking and writing, changes in mood and personality. As we fight against other diseases and live longer lives, Alzheimer's looms on the horizon as if waiting for us to pass the test of other challenges. As a cause of death from 2000 to 2013, many things decreased, but Alzheimer's has grown. Stopping it, preventing it, postponing its development in our brains long enough that we at least die of something else with our memories is a real goal we can achieve. Your brain fits inside this thing, your skull. Specifically, this part back here called the brain case or neurocranium. It's a bone fortress protecting an inner sanctuary called the cranial cavity. Your brain sits right here, except it doesn't really sit so much as it swims. You see, the brain is incredibly fragile and soft and gooey. Model or toy brains tend to be made out of rigid plastic, and actual specimens used in dissection tend to be rubbery because they've been affected by chemicals like formaldehyde. But real, raw, fresh brains, right out of someone's brain case, are soft, like soft tofu. Holding one like this for too long will leave a lasting hand-shaped depression. For that reason, the brain has to float so it doesn't crush itself under its own weight. But it doesn't float in water. Instead, it floats in a special liquid your body makes called cerebrospinal fluid. Now, this isn't a whole brain. This is just the cerebrum, the largest part of the brain. It plays a key role in language, thought, abstract thinking, awareness, consciousness. It thinks it's a pretty big deal. Literally, it's the part of you that does thinking. Anyway, the outside of the cerebrum is called the cortex. Cortex means bark, like tree bark, or a rind, or a husk. If I tear off one of the temporal lobes, we can take a closer look at this rind. It's painted in maroon here. You can see its extent. It's only about 2 to 4 millimeters thick. It's often called gray matter because it appears pinkish, yellowish gray in a real brain. Beneath it is the white matter. White because although gray matter contains a lot of cell bodies, the white matter contains mainly axons that are myelinated that send messages from gray matter to gray matter locations. Myelin is a whitish material that insulates electric messages, allowing them to move faster. And fast, they do move. Signals travel through axons at up to 432 kilometers per hour. That's 275 miles per hour. About the top speed of the fastest production car in the world. You could say this car literally travels at the speed of thought. But that's slow compared to the speed of electricity through a conductor, which is closer to 50 to 99% the speed of light. Anyway, the brain is very wrinkly, and that's because a wrinkled shape allows more cerebral cortex to fit into a smaller container. If we could take this entire rind, all of your cerebral cortex, and flatten it out, it would be, well, about like this. It would be about 2 to 4 millimeters thick and have an area equivalent to a square 50 centimeters by 50 centimeters, about 20 by 20 inches. Obviously, you can't fit this shape into this shape unless you crumple it up. Ah, and now we're getting somewhere. When we crumple the brain up, we get folds. The folds are called gyri, singular gyrus. And the crevices are called sulci, singular sulcus. About two-thirds of your cerebral cortex is buried deep within sulci out of view. As for memories, well, every time you learn something new or memorize something new, your brain doesn't gain another wrinkle or anything like that. Instead, memories appear to be more about connections, relationships, and patterns formed by connected neurons. When neurons fire together again and again, rehearse, their connections and bonds become stronger. They become more likely to fire together again, to be recalled. Roughly, that might be how memory works, and it's a helpful way to think about some interesting phenomena, like the fact that it's quite difficult to list off the name of every book you've ever read. That's like really difficult. But if someone were to just name book titles, you could effortlessly tell them whether or not you'd read the book. Hearing the title likely excites neuron connections more directly involved with the connections associated with your memory of having read that title than a mere prompt to name some books you've read. When brain cells and their connections are damaged, blocked, compromised, or killed, memories can fade and the formation of new memories can be hampered. Learning how this happens in Alzheimer's isn't just important for those diagnosed, but also for all of us interested in memory. In 1-5% of Alzheimer's cases, genetic differences can be identified. But the cause of most cases is still mostly unknown. A number of hypotheses and observations exist. For example, we know that 15% of individuals with Down syndrome who live 40 years or longer develop Alzheimer's disease, and 50-70% of those who live to 60 do. Down syndrome is caused by the presence of all or part of a third copy of chromosome 21. We still have a lot to learn, but chromosome 21 is also involved in the plaques found in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. Within this chromosome are the genetic instructions for the production of a protein called amyloid precursor protein, or APP. APP seems to play a role in neural growth and repair. It's found on cells throughout the entire body. It's processed by the body in different ways. Most often, an enzyme called alpha secretase cleaves it into SAPP-alpha and C83. Less often, an enzyme called beta secretase snips APP a bit higher up, releasing a smaller fragment called SAPP-beta. A third enzyme can then come along, gamma secretase, and cleave AICD away, leaving P3 if alpha secretase acted first, and beta amyloid if beta secretase acted first. The normal function of beta amyloid isn't exactly known yet. It may play an important role in healthy brain function, but if too much is made, or maybe if too little is cleared away too slowly, or if the protein folds in the wrong ways, fragments can stick together, creating oligomers, groups of a few pieces, say 4 or 5. These oligomer gangs can then stick to other oligomers and become larger structures called plaques. The effect oligomers and plaques have on brain cells and brain health is being studied. Oligomers may be more toxic. They may allow unregulated ion flow into neurons, causing their deaths. What we do know is that Alzheimer's disease is associated with these plaques in the brain, as well as another protein-related anomaly, tangles. A protein called tau stabilizes microtubules in brain cells, like railroad ties holding tracks together, the tracks that guide nutrients and other molecules throughout the cell. In many neurodegenerative diseases, tau proteins become abnormally sticky and tangle with other tau proteins, compromising the delivery network. We do know some factors associated with increased or decreased risk, but their exact relationships with cognitive decline aren't all certain. Things associated with a reduced risk for Alzheimer's disease include physical activity, a heart-healthy diet, learning a second language later in life, being social, frequently interacting with people, protecting your head, and intellectual activities like crossword puzzles, playing instruments, reading, board games, education. Such activities may improve overall brain health and cognitive skills, leaving you with a brain more resilient to damage should it come. Whatever the case, there's a lot more we can learn. It is incredible, and exciting and a little scary to realize how much more we have to learn about the brain. We know more about the orbital mechanics of distant binary stars than we do about the very mechanisms we use to know about them in the first place. Inner space is as mysterious and deep as outer space.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
Well, so we meet again. He said he'd grown spiritually since the last time.
Okay, this is the dawning of the Book of Bitter Aspects, when a jackal sit and watch the pedagogue's last breath. Poison function accompanied by six armor clad black horse and buggy mechanisms tugged a portion of my severed vision. Gathering of loose ends in a bucket with a shoestring budget. Every man's gotta feel supply.
I know that now.
But it's like, man, I really can't afford the oxen, fee fi, etc. I smell the warm blood of the bill collector knocking. I get awkwardly sturdy with a frigid liquid backbone. I get swept in a pressure cooker trying to paddle back home. I get sprung with a vibe and alliance of clean intention by eclipsing doom litigants hatched to bash these picket fences. Now I'll attend the wedding of the open sword and festering. And when the groom presents the ring, the bride commenced the blistering. Textbook magnificently crude. Prototype King Berserker module inserted vertical thirst, burst horizontal. Treasure, loose cannon span, a starboard bow with a clipper ship dipped in truth, famine, pressure. Cabin fever made a peggy ludicrous. Beautiful cartoon trooper swallow brutal futility with a teaspoon full of sugar. I rock ready, aim fire, when y'all rock ready, fire aim. Then blame the stationary target while the prey escapes the frame. Merit bad marks for the poacher, it's all the same. So I lay across the wood perpendicular to the grain.
Gotta be a big bang, gotta be. Never mind, I'll be a bit of property. I wanna see you get, sir, sir.
Yes, sir.
All with a torn cross or to the bone. One the other brothers I was born for a long big bang. Shoving in a big dick, huddled in a tunnel of big dreams. I think big things, I'm a burn with a still a lot of mind and a proud concern to earn thanks. I'ma be a big bang. I wanna be a big bang, gotta be. Never mind, I'll be a bit of property. I wanna see you get, sir, sir.
Yes, sir.
All with a torn cross or to the bone. One the other brothers I was born for a long big bang. Shoving in a big dick, huddled in a tunnel of big dreams. I think big things, I'm a burn with a still a lot of mind and a proud concern to earn thanks. I'ma be a big bang.
Survivor of the woolly mammoth population, bottleneck effect, sort of born deaf, alien, a shallow alchemy. If you gon' metamorph the base metal to precious, might as well steal from the rich, bewitch the peasants. I'm floating this homing pigeon out hell's kitchen window, left an SOS infested bottle nestled in his grip. So with a prayer circle, release party and hearty wild bellow. I observed him fly 10 feet, then drop the bottles to the devils. Fertile circle, turn fertile crescent via bad investment, despised every second. But I guess I learned my lesson.
If I made an angel in the snow for every rotting victim, there'd be wings to float this mothership about the goblin system.
Sticky panoramic contaminant planet in conjunction with phantom assumption, gutter bug alumnus candidates. Whoa. Well, I promise you I'll man the lighthouse just to help guide in your ship. If you promise to help pull this hook out my lip,
bitch.
Godspeed, straight jacket and ragged approach to circle suns via folklore pollutants derived strictly from a BC generation disgust. Community movement alluding to a
no blood given,
no recognition, life matter. I sup all night with a rusty hammer, trying to build a fence around these magic beans my dreams have gathered. But that certain lack of a veil, I sail a choppy lot with buoyancy like a bucket of rocks.
A bucket of rocks.
I wanna be a big bang, gotta be. Never mind, I'll be a better probably. I wanna see you again, sir, sir.
Yes, sir.
All with a torn course or to the bone. One the other brothers I was born for, long big bang. Shoving in a big dig, huddled in a tunnel of big dreams. I think big things. I'ma burn with the spittle out of mine and a proud concern to earth. Thanks, I'ma be a big bang. I wanna be a big bang, gotta be. Never mind, I'll be a better probably. I wanna see you again, sir, sir.
Yes, sir.
All with a torn course or to the bone. One the other brothers I was born for, long big bang. Shoving in a big dig, huddled in a tunnel of big dreams. I think big things. I'ma burn with the spittle out of mine and a proud concern to earth. Thanks, I'ma be a big bang.
Big bang. Big bang. It's getting bigger by the second. Check
okay,
it.
Okay, I'm here to rock the tugboat and bid the elders farewell. I shook the buddy system wisdom till the similars repel. I sell a barrel of spirit to dummy dimwit syndicate jackals. I'm broken arrow to the meat of bone.
Broken poem.
I don't really believe in God, but God, I'm scared to death of God. I swear to God, I never meant to spill the beans nor tear the pie. But it's like I hike an acre unimpressed and slept on a saber's edge. Enough times to splice Antichrist's favorite pledge.
I wanna know myself.
Sort of solo sheep amidst wolves and still.
My shepherd can't administer the proper push and pulls. I push the ghouls to man overboard. Pull the bulls onto my sword and buckle down in a corner chair at a round table floor. Got an angel on my left shoulder, a devil on a polar. Got a mug of frigid, got a mug of solar. Slide over. The recipe's designed. I plug the appetite for continuity by stitching together an esteemed congruence.
Beautifully.
I peel back hearts and lots. Greet physics in the chambers. Quarterize the wound and heads like gimme something major. Outside prophetic, a Sam well. Enveloped in a mummy ribbon system. Blistering in a wishing well. Big bang.
Now, go find the others. .com.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.